Call House State Affairs Committee to order at 3:01 on Tuesday, February 11th. Welcome everyone. Madam Secretary, could you call the roll?
Representative Vance?
Here.
Representative Shaw?
Here.
Representative Hopkins?
Here.
Representative Story?
Here.
Representative Thompson?
Here.
Representative Fields?
Here.
Representative Price Tompkins?
Here.
Okay, thanks everyone for joining us. Welcome, Representative Hannon. First, thanks to House Records Martha Moore, our moderator Madison Truitt. A quick item on the agenda. So, we have the privilege of passing House Bill 182 twice, which is exciting. Last week, because there was a sponsor substitute, the bill that we acted on last week needs to be acted on again. So this is now the third hearing in House State Affairs for House Bill 182, and because I want to get to House Bill 74 and the Ocean Ranger program, we're going to move through 182 pretty quickly. So just to explain what we're going to do is we're going to adopt the CS as the working document, and then we're going to go ahead and move the legislation because we've already heard and had public testimony. So, Mr. Co-Chairman, do you have a motion on House Bill 182?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I move to adopt version 31-LS1188/U as an umbrella from as the working document.
Thank you. Seeing no objections, that is the working document before the committee. Representative Tarr has staff here, but this is the same bill that we just adopted without objection last week. So with that, is there a motion to move House Bill 182?
Brief at ease, Mr. Chair.
On the record, do we have a motion on House Bill 182?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I move HB 182 version 31-LS1188/U as umbrella from committee as amended with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal note.
Okay. Seeing no objection, that motion passes. We're going to take a brief at ease to sign paperwork and for Commissioner Bruni and his staff to queue up their presentation on House Bill 74 at ease. Back on the record, this is the first hearing in House State Affairs for House Bill 74, which is the governor's bill to, at this point, update the Ocean Ranger program. It does not repeal ocean pollution monitoring, as the original title suggests. I want to thank the commissioner and his staff for working over the past few months to consider what's a good modernization for the Ocean Ranger program. This is a conversation that we started having probably 8 months ago, following, actually it would be even longer than that, it was about a year ago, following budget deliberations last year where there was discussion of how's the Ocean Ranger program work now, can we make it work better? So thanks to the commissioner and staff for thinking about that, and the purpose of this hearing is to talk about a rewritten House Bill 74, and certainly I would like to hear from public and stakeholders about where we go with this program. So with that, Commissioner, if you and your staff want to go through the presentation.
Sure. Chair Fields, Chair Christ Tompkins, members of the committee, it's an honor to be before you today. For the record, my name is Jason Bruni. I'm the Commissioner of the Department of Environmental Conservation. I'm joined here by Emma Pocon, the Deputy Commissioner of DEC. I also have in the audience with me Randy Bates and Amber LeBlanc, who are the with the Water Division, the Water Director. And so we're looking forward to this presentation. As Chair Fields said, last year at about this time, there was discussion about the Ocean Ranger program, and I made a commitment to work during the interim with my team to develop a program that is effectively a new and improved or a modernized approach to the Ocean Ranger program that was put into place via the initiative process about 12 years ago. What this bill does is it clarifies that indeed the cruise industry will be regulated in a similar manner to other industries. That's kind of been one of the things I've said over and over again. In addition, it will state that existing statutes that currently limit DEC's ability to effectively monitor cruise ship emissions and discharges, and this improves that, as well as this committee substitute maintains our authority and adds flexibility to how it's used.
question, Representative Story.
Yes, thank you. Could you give me an example of like another industry and how you've regulated that, please?
Sure, Representative Story, through the chair. There are most industries, I would say, if they're lucky, get one inspection per year. And that includes wastewater treatment facilities for local communities, the oil and gas industry, the mining industry, the fishing industry. They generally have one or maybe a couple of inspections on an annual basis. They do not have 24/7 monitoring or even 75% or 50% monitoring at those facilities.
I really appreciate the spirit of this CSA. I just want to point out that in commercial fishing, there is such a thing as 100% observer coverage. It's not one-to-one, but the notion of regulatory oversight in some of these other industries, I think there may be parallel examples, especially when we're talking about Bering Sea trawl fish
sure,
industries yeah. in Gulf of Alaska, bottom trawl fisheries.
Tompkins, that is correct. I was intimately involved at a number of North Pacific Fisheries Management Council meetings in my previous life, and there is coverage for those ships for counting fish, but not for every environmental discharge or other things that the regulatory agencies cover. It is effectively just for counting species and for counting the numbers and the sizes and the total biomass is what the council process usually does, is my understanding. So in the past, I think it's important to understand where we are and where we want to go to. This past year, obviously, when the initiative was passed, it required 100% coverage on each of the cruise ships. That 100% coverage was never met. This past year, there were 22, typically around 22 ocean rangers that were on vessels throughout the summer season. I believe around 90% of those were non-Alaskans, I believe. Somewhere between 3 or 4 were Alaskans. The ocean rangers were observers. They were not inspectors. They performed inspections in port as well as underway. And the majority of my team's time was spent going through the reports that they would receive from the ocean rangers. What the ocean rangers would do is they would look for non-compliance issues with respect to marine discharge and other pollution requirements. They would also ensure proper sanitation, health, and safety practices for both the passengers and the crew. And just to reiterate, they were observers. They were not inspectors. And what they would do is they would pass on their observations and their concerns to DEC for further investigation.
Can I ask a question on that, Commissioner?
Yeah, sure.
So my understanding of the DEC interpretation of statute is that each vessel needs to have at least one inspection per year to achieve 100% coverage under the law. How many sailings actually have Ocean Ranger coverage? I know that some boats make many sailings in the summer.
Through the chair, my understanding, or Chair Field, sorry, you are the chair, approximately 60 to 70% of the vessels currently have Ocean Ranger coverage on them in a given season. That number used to be higher earlier on, but that number has fallen. It's above 50%, but it's, I think, in the 60 to 70% range.
Great, thanks.
Confirming that's correct. And as I was saying, that the Ocean Rangers were observers. They were not inspectors. And so they would often pass their daily reports on to our staff. So some of the efficiencies of the current program. Over the last 12 years since this initiative was passed, we've spent roughly $40 million on the Ocean Ranger contract. This contract, during that time, there were a total of 6 notices of violation that were attributable to Ocean Ranger observations. That's out of a total of 264 notices of violations. So as I've said in the past, if this was a general funded program, it likely would have been eliminated years ago. It is funded $5 per lower berth currently. And so you look at this and you see 6 out of 264 notices of violations. Is that money well spent? And most of the NOVs are either observations and violations from DEC staff or they're self-reported by the industry itself. So what this bill does that I'm going to be presenting today is it provides a simplified fee structure, and I'll go through each one of these in more detail later on. It moves the details of the statutes that were in the initial initiative to regulation. It's going to allow for the incorporation of technology into the monitoring, and it's going to update the ultimate goal is to use some of the funds to upgrade wastewater systems in port communities through a grant or loan program similar to the Village Safe Water or State Revolving Fund that we have in place already.
Thanks, Representative Story.
Yeah, thank you. Sorry about that. I just wanted to go back to your comments about six of the notices actually attributed to the Ocean Rangers. Wouldn't, since their main purpose being on board and notifying people they were not investigating, but couldn't one assume that just knowing they were on board might make one who worked there record things more? I mean, I just think they probably, it says six, but just common sense would tell me that they attributed just by their presence to more best practices.
Through the chair, Representative Story. So I think that I understand that perspective, and I can actually agree with it to some extent. But if an entity wanted to do something nefarious, obviously the Ocean Ranger doesn't work 24 hours a day. They do other inspections around the boat. They inspect the sneeze guards on the salad bars. If they wanted to do something nefarious, the company could do that, regardless if there was someone on board or not. What we're going to be proposing in this bill is that a similar type of effect would occur when you don't know if a DEC inspector is going to come and do a surprise inspection or not. They may or they may not be there today. You always have to be ready. We will do, as I'll be talking about, we'll be doing inspections early on, announced and unannounced inspections, and that has a similar type of deterrent effect to having someone on the boat 24/7.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. I appreciate those comments. I just wanted to say that I think that they probably attributed to more than six. But
right. Sure.
Yeah.
So currently, and I'm going to show you what's actually in statute first. It's actually pretty confusing how the fee structure is assessed. And what it does is it assesses a fees based on the size of the number of lower berths. So you'll see the charge would be $175 for a commercial vessel with overnight accommodations for at least 100, but not more than 249 for hire. And then it goes down through 10 different components based on the size of the vessel. What we're proposing in this is to make it a $4 per berth fee for the Ocean Ranger expense for large for vessels, and a $1 for the CPVEC. So it's going to be a simplified $5 per berth fee. This expense will, or this change will start in 2021. So some of the what you see in the bill is to accommodate what we have and the legislative intent language for the 2020 season, but it will take effect in 2021. But the intent ultimately is to have a $5 per berth fee that will be put into the commercial passenger vessel environmental compliance fund. When we did an assessment, assessment for what the industry would pay, the larger vessels effectively are going to pay the exact same, and the small vessels will see a slight increase in fees because they were not covered in the previous statutes, and they will see, in addition to that, an increase in the oversight that goes along with the smaller vessels.
Representative Story has a question.
Yes, could you give me an idea of what possibly that fee could be? When you say the small vessels will see an increase in fees, can you give me an idea of how?
Well, through the chair, Representative Story, it depends on the number of voyages that ship makes, and it'll be a $5 per berth fee, which they currently don't pay. So if they weren't assessed it and there was 100 berths on the ship, it would be a $500 per voyage additional cost for that vessel. Many of the smaller vessels, Representative Story, are luxury vessels. Mm-hmm. But I think the full cost increase was around, I believe, $60,000 for the smaller vessels over the course of the full season, spread across the smaller vessels. So the total is around 60 grand in addition.
Thank you.
And I might ask a follow-up on that. So if I'm reading this right, these are overnight vessels?
Through the chair fields, yes.
So we're not talking about the small boats that go out of Auk Bay and do whale watching. These are your luxury cruise ships that maybe have 175 passengers and go into Glacier Bay, just for example.
That is correct.
Thanks. I think Representative Vance had a question. Oh, okay. Please continue.
Our ultimate goal, obviously, through a number of the discussions I had as we were talking about this bill with a number of you as well as with legislators and frankly, residents of Alaska, was a desire to incorporate technology and to stay current with technology. So what this CS does is it removes the sections of statutes that are really overly detailed. Generally, when statutes are passed, DEC has regulations that we can change the regulations that allow us to incorporate the technology and incorporate new technology and increasing environmental standards and for monitoring those environmental standards. What we had in place with this initiative and what's currently in there is a lot more detail. So what this bill will do is give DEC more flexibility, and it will we will write regulations that address the items that are ultimately removed from the statute. By putting it in regulation, like I said, it gives us the ability to respond to the increases in technology and incorporating those things without having to come back to you time and time again to incorporate that. And with the electronic monitoring that we heard so often that they want to incorporate, that potentially could allow us to do 24/7 electronic monitoring of the ship's discharge without having people on the boats.
And Commissioner, as structured, you would envision this bill allowing the department to either do that monitoring itself or hire a contractor to do it with oversight by the department?
Chair Fields, yes, that is correct. I have often said that if we have we should have the highest of environmental standards, and indeed we do have the highest of environmental standards in the world in Alaska, and I'm very proud of that. One of the things I like, though, is that we should not only hold industry to a high standard, but we should hold ourselves to that same high standard. This graphic illustrates this point to, I think, to a profound point. Ships currently, large cruise ship permits, are allowed to discharge up to 40 fecal coliform colonies per 100 milliliters of water. Concurrently, local wastewater treatment facilities are allowed to discharge up to 1.5 million fecal coliform forming units per 100 milliliters of water. Now, I want to make sure I'm clear. I am not suggesting that the cruise ships should be allowed to discharge at 1.5 million fecal coliform. I am suggesting that we should work, do everything in our power to bring the local communities up to that high standard that the cruise industry is already meeting. And of course, many of the folks that are on these cruise ships, they're using shoreside facilities. They're having a nice steak dinner. They're then debarking and going on an excursion, and they need to use shore facilities. Many of these communities were not built to accommodate the large number of visitors to their community. So what I'm going to be proposing as part of this bill actually will help use some of this money to upgrade those systems. So I put in this packet just a couple of the communities to focus on. Now, through the Clean Water Act, there is something called a 301H waiver. That means that the EPA still oversees the wastewater discharges from those communities. And so you will see that the communities of Sitka and Skagway and Ketchikan still are allowed to discharge up to 1 million or even 1.5 million fecal coliform per 100 milliliters of water.
Commissioner, are these the only communities that have this waiver, or is this just kind of a selected list?
Chair Fields, this is a selected list. We included those communities that are visited frequently by cruise ships for this presentation. There are also communities that are called 301H-like waivers that are similar, but they're not quite 301H waivers from the EPA.
Yeah. Do you know offhand where Huna is? I know they're experiencing increased cruise visitation.
through the chair, Chair Fields, I'm going to turn around and I'm going to look to see if my team can be a lifeline. Chair Fields, we will get back to you with an answer on HUNA. Yeah.
Did not anticipate that far enough in advance to send to you. Yeah. Representative Hopkins.
No, no, no. Okay.
I have a question.
Representative Story had a question.
Chair Fields, I have the list of all of the communities that have 301H waivers, and HUNA is not on this list. So that's.
Representative Story.
Yeah, I just wanted to clarify that your intent is to keep with large cruise ships permit allowing up to 40 fecal colony farming.
Through the chair, Representative Story, we are not changing the requirements at all. We're just trying to ensure that we try to bring the local communities that have wastewater discharge up to a higher level, a level that is better for the environment.
Thank you.
Because of the implementation time of this bill, we have to do something that's proposed for the 2020 season, and then 2021 will be the full program will be implemented. So what we are proposing with the fiscal note in this bill is that we will contract with marine engineers, we currently have one marine engineer on staff. We're looking to hire an additional one. Every single cruise ship that comes into Alaska will have an initial inspection within the first couple of weeks of being in Alaska waters. At that point, there will be both announced and unannounced inspections on a regular basis when they are at port as well as when they are underway.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, could you speak to the sort of scope of expertise of a marine engineer? I'm a little sort of flat-footed in understanding what their sort of professional scope is. My starting point is when somebody says a marine engineer, I think of MEBA and the ferry system and marine engineers as being the people who keep the diesels running on a large vessel. What is a marine engineer in the context of cruise ship wastewater compliance?
Co-Chair Christ-Tompkins, through Chair Fields, that's a great question and one I commit to getting you more information about later. I will tell you that I know that they have extensive experience on boats. They have had extensive training over the years, there is a certain type of classification and certification that marine engineers have. What we will use them for is to look at the, for lack of a better word, the as-built of the ship, and to go in and confirm that everything that they claim is there. There's not additional, as one would call them, magic pipes or other things that aren't on the, I don't know what the technical term is, but as built, and they will confirm what's here and what's supposed to be here. I know that that's what we will do as part of the early season inspections, but I also know that they have a lot more qualifications, which I'm not doing justice to right now. So I'll get back to you with a more detailed answer on that.
Thank you.
Following up on that, do you know if any other states have similar enforcement regimes, and for states that have a large amount of cruise visitation, do they have a similar workforce in terms of marine engineers, and does that workforce differ if we see more advanced filtration systems on very large cruise ships?
Chair Fields,
answer now, but that'd be interesting to hear about.
Chair Fields, I commit to getting back to you and to the committee with more details about what other states and jurisdictions indeed have in place. I do know that what I have been told is Alaska has some of the highest environmental standards with the current program that we have in place in the world, and. You know, we commit to maintaining that with this program, with this improved program that we have.
And a follow-up to that, I'm also curious. I know these are very high-skill jobs, and I'm curious about what is the workforce out there, and kind of if we go in this direction, what's the timeline going to be of onboarding people to do these really skilled jobs?
So, Chair Fields, one of the reasons, obviously, that we only have three or four of our current ocean rangers are Alaskans is because it is a highly technical, highly qualified workforce that we don't have many in Alaska that have that. And I believe there's one who got an exemption from being a marine engineer that is an Alaskan. our thought would be bringing on one additional marine engineer to work at DEC, so we have two of them, and then the others would be actual inspectors. So they would not, and then when we need marine engineers for the early season inspections that are going to be done on each vessel, we would bring in a contract. For future years, we may make that seasonal, like a temporary position, or we may have a contract. We haven't made that decision yet going forward. As it shows in the fiscal note, what we propose to do is to create four new DEC positions. When you prorate that over the year, that will ultimately lead to 10 DEC staff that'll be available for doing the cruise ship inspections, either in port or while they are underway. And of course, as DEC staff, they will have the ability to issue NOVs and do these inspections and compliance and enforcement actions. As I indicated, but I think it's worth repeating, that these inspections, like every other industry, will be random and targeted, but they will also be announced. So you need, in order to have a good regulatory regime, you need to make sure you have teeth in your laws, and you need to make sure that you're doing inspections and not always going there when they think you're going to be there.
Thank you. The four new DEC positions, where will those be based?
Representative Story, through the chair, I imagine that in Southeast we have one office at DEC, and that's in Juneau. And so I imagine that at least for the cruise ship season, they will be predominantly based in Southeast Alaska. Throughout the rest of the year, obviously, they will have other inspection duties that they do. But, you know, the cruise ships, they visit Homer and Anchorage and Dutch Harbor, and we'll want to make sure that we're not just focusing on Southeast Alaska waters for inspections. In order to be random and targeted, you need to make sure you're showing up at all of the ports of call. So I would imagine most will be based in Southeast, but I wouldn't be surprised if we had one in Anchorage as well, but I don't know exactly. I'll have to defer to my water team for definitive answers when we get there.
Thank you.
Representative Shaw.
Yes, thank you, through the chair. I don't know if this question's appropriate in some respects. Does the Alaska Marine Highway System have to meet the same environmental oversight requirements as the cruise ship industry? And the reason I ask that is because we do move people around sort of as a cruise ship, but the Marine Highway System, curiosity.
Representative Shaw, through the chair, indeed, yes, they are required to meet the same standards. However, they do not. What was put in the initiative initially was it afforded the Commissioner of DEC and the Commissioner of DOT the flexibility to negotiate the cost that would be charged per berth for those for the ferries. What has been traditionally negotiated is zero fee, and what we have in this committee substitute is language that is conforming to that, and that process will remain in place where we don't charge a fee for the lower berths of ferries.
Thank you.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, could you provide a bit of a refresher in terms of this question of small cruise ships and also ferries, as far as a bill that passed the legislature maybe two legislatures ago, I think, that was sponsored by Senator Stedman, and all I remember is it had something to do with wastewater discharge exemptions for ferries and small cruise ships. Is this ringing a bell, or do you know how this fits into this current question of compliance?
Co-Chair Christ-Tompkins, if a bill like that passed, I am unaware of it, and so if I misspoke, I will commit to researching that issue and getting back with the committee on that. My apologies. I'm not aware of that bill.
and to be clear, I'm not suggesting you misspoke. I just remember it passing four or so years ago, and I think I, as much as you, will circle back to get a sense of how relevant it is.
And Co-Chair Christ-Tompkins, I mean, my opinion is as I said earlier, we should hold state ferries to the same standards that we hold industry, to the same standards that we want to hold local communities. I think that if we have an environmental standard, where and what entities are discharging should be adhered to by all entities.
Following up on that, I would be interested in seeing industry trends with respect to these smaller kind of luxury cruises. My sense is that it's a growing growing segment of the market, but I don't know that. I would just like to understand it to the extent that DEC monitors that.
Chair Fields, just so I understand, that are you talking about the number of smaller vessels that are coming and using Alaska for a destination as opposed to what it was, like a trend of growth over the years?
In Alaska, therefore, you know, if we're making these changes and we're encompassing more of these vessels, are we kind of addressing a trend that's happening in the marketplace?
Yeah, Chair Fields, absolutely. And that's one of the reasons why we are going to be incorporating inspections of those smaller vessels into our regime, because I think it's important that cumulatively they can have a significant impact as well. So we need to make sure that we have oversight of them. I think Representative Shaw already asked the question that talks about the repeal and reenactment of 4603-482C. That is specific to the ferries. This bill also repeals citizen suits, and it has a number of conforming changes that I mentioned many of them earlier. The effective dates, what you'll see in this bill is that immediately or retroactively to April 1st of this year, assuming this bill is passed, the Ocean Ranger will be repealed, and the fees will apply to DEC's activities. So that currently, I believe on an annual basis, has been around a $3.5 million contract. The sum, as you saw in one of my previous slides, was around $40 million since inception that have gone to this out of, or to this contract, that amount will go directly then to DEC for our efforts. And then January 1st of next year, the $5 fee will be in place and the new regs will be in place.
Commissioner, on this point, I would be interested in seeing how the department would anticipate an inspection regime maintaining at least some equivalence with the Ocean Ranger regime in terms of number of vessels inspected, number of sailings, so the public has some confidence that, you know, it's an update of the program, but we still have coverage. Personally, I think unannounced random inspections are going to have a greater deterrent effect, but, you know, looking at how we shift, making sure we still have coverage, I think would be good to hear about in the future.
Chair Fields, I think that that's a great point, that by having 10 DEC staff that are committed to doing inspections, as well as having every single vessel inspected early on in the season, I can't commit to what that number is right now, but I am more than happy to do a report back to the legislature that shows how many of the ships we ultimately inspected, and you know, at that point, see if it meets the expectations of the legislature.
And Representative Grayson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On the previous slide, additional changes, slide 14, what are citizens' suits? What does that mean?
I'm going to let Emma Pocan answer that.
So the bill is going to repeal AS-46.
I'd like to show up on the record. Oh,
thank you. For the record, Emma Pocan, I'm the Deputy Commissioner at DEC. Representative Chris Tompkins, currently in statute 4603-481 provides for citizen suits where any member of the public can bring a lawsuit against the owner operator of a cruise ship or against the department where there's a failure to do something that person feels they ought to have done. That's a provision that's unlike any other provision in the statute. And typically, DEC will have the flexibility to decide how to approach any particular violation that occurs and how the best, what the best course of action is with respect to enforcement.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Has that provision in law ever been employed by an aggrieved citizen?
Jason Bruni back on the record. So as we discuss the fiscal impacts of this, the large ships will see little change. The fees will go up for small vessels in 2021. We do propose to have a contract for marine engineer inspections, which will be obviously considerably lower for ocean rangers. It should be for just a couple of weeks and should be able to be done onshore, maybe even at one consistent location for when they get into Juneau. Yeah, we might go into multiple communities if they're only visiting, say, Dutch Harbor and Nome. We might have to have an inspector there, but I think that we'll play that one by ear based on what the voyage schedule is. But the contract will definitely be shorter than the full season marine engineer requirement for ocean rangers currently. The fiscal note does show the expenditure for the 2020 cruise season as a supplemental item. And the personal services and other support costs for the four new positions that I discussed will ultimately add to our baseline budget.
And I guess I should have asked one more question. So there is money currently that's been collected in Ocean Ranger fees. And as you've designed this bill, whatever money is there could be used for these purposes as we kind of transition to a new regulatory regime. Is that how you would envision this working?
Chair Fields, absolutely. We have, I believe, around $10 million in it right now, and we'll use it for those functions. We just need the authority to be able to spend that money. Now, as I've discussed, but I want to just reiterate that the ultimate goal, as I said, around $3.5 million, over $40 million over 12 years, has been spent on this Ocean Ranger contract. This proposal, what you have in the bill before you, proposes to use that money, about 50% or so, whatever money is left over on an annual basis from the collection of these, the $5 per berth fee, would be used for upgrading shore-based wastewater treatment facilities in the communities that are visited by and affected by the cruise industry. So it would ultimately have a significant positive environmental impact on those communities that are visited by cruise ship folks. And so that would ultimately require future appropriation and capital appropriation by this body for those. And the ultimate goal would be to have a program, like I said, similar to Village Safe Water or the State Revolving Fund, where communities would have to demonstrate need. They would have to demonstrate skin in the game. Right now we have these programs, like I said, Village Safe Water, which the community demonstrates need. They have to show how they're what skin in the game they're going to be paying for. We have low interest loans, we have grants as well as loan forgiveness, but it'll be working with DEC staff to put a program together that upgrades those systems. And we have a similar model in place with the Village Safe Water and the State Revolving Loan Fund that is currently exists.
Representative Anthony.
Well, thank you. He just answered. I was going to ask him to expound upon what you envision the grant program to be, and you just filled in all the blanks before I could ask the question, so thank you.
Thank you, Representative Vance. Ultimately, I think it's also important to talk about what's not going to change. Our commitment is to making sure that the waters of Alaska are protected, that we are open for business for those companies that are choosing Alaska as a destination, but that we are ensuring that our high environmental standards are going to be adhered to by those companies, and putting that authority with DEC staff and DEC inspectors. So our authority to conduct those inspections at reasonable times will not change. If there is any kind of opposition, we do have the authority to get a warrant already. Regardless if this bill is passed, we can do that to do inspections. What also will not change, our vessel registration system. That is required for any passenger vessel that has more than 50 overnight berths. In this proposal, in fact, we've already done it at DEC. The air monitoring, which was put in place through the initiative process, is being done by the Air Division. We've moved it. It used to be done as a component of the Water Division. Air has the expertise. to monitor air. So that's not going to change. We've just moved it within the air division.
Question on that. To what extent do air emissions get put in the water if they're an open loop system versus a closed loop system? I may be misremembering the terminology. I know different cruise ships have different technology. Could you just talk about that a little bit?
Chair Fields, absolutely. I know that there are different technologies that the different ships have. Some of them do put it back into the water. They convert the sulfur and by discharging it into the water with their conversion process, they don't see any impact on the sulfur content in proximity, is what I've been told. And the different companies have different processes. Some of them have scrubbers on their stack. Some of them have that conversion process for putting the sulfur into the water.
Got it. And for those who put it back in the water, does that then become something that staff and water monitor, or how does that work from a regulatory perspective?
Chair Fields, I will get more information on that. I know that we do monitor it, but I've been told that the amounts of sulfur that have put back in are so far below what is naturally occurring that it has no that the impact is negligible.
Representative Price.
Thank you. First, just to add a trailer to my previous comment or question, the piece of legislation I have been refreshed by two different people now that I was recalling was SB3 from the 30th legislature, which at least from the short title exempted vessels under 250 feet. So I think to sharpen my question, my question for the department would be, are there any provisions of this work draft that the department is proposing that alter or otherwise repeal provisions in the law that were established by SB3 in the 30th legislature? And you don't need to answer right now, but just knowing if we're walking back anything from SB3 or changing anything from SB3 would be helpful for reference.
This is Emma Pocan again for the record. Representative Chris Tompkins through the chair. There are provisions in the bill, and I can't tell you off the top of my head which, if any, were adopted through SB3 in 2017. There are places where we've removed some of the detail with the intention that detail would be put into regulation. So the intent is not to change any of those provisions in the current scheme. It would just be moving them to regulation so that we have the flexibility to react to changing circumstances in the future.
Follow up.
Yes.
I'll read the bill, but my understanding is that SB3 exempted all vessels. They're under 250 berths or 250 feet. I can't remember which it was. From wastewater discharge standards, and at least earlier in this presentation, my recollection is that this bill would encompass those vessels with wastewater discharge regulations, reestablish those regulations. Can you help me reconcile this bill vis-a-vis that exemption established by SB3?
Representative Chris Tompkins to the chair. The idea is that those provisions would be in regulation. DEC would continue to have the authority to distinguish between different classes of dischargers, right? So you could have a set of rules that apply to those large vessels and a set of rules that apply to smaller vessels because the type of risk that they present is different, right? So you can apply the best management practices as we do today for those smaller vessels and require the MPs. And then for the larger vessels, you continue to require the more robust permit coverage.
Thank you. And then I'll look forward to diving into this more, I'm sure, with your staff, but thanks for the answer. To this slide, on the air reporting requirements, noted that it's moving from water division to air division. That all makes sense, at least on a high level. Could you walk us through what programmatically or operationally air monitoring looks like right now for DEC of cruise ships?
Representative Chris Tompkins. So right now there's the opacity monitoring using method 9, which my understanding is it's monitoring that's done from shore. There's been in the last couple of years some of the ambient air monitors and monitoring done as sort of a test project, and I think it still remains to be seen to the extent to which that will be continued or expanded or not. But the primary air emissions monitoring that the department has done and that will continue to do is the opacity monitoring using method 9.
Follow up. Can you explain what's entailed in opacity monitoring?
Representative Chris Tompkins. So I'm not a monitor myself, and I have to follow up with you about the details of that. And the details of Method 9, but we can get that to you.
Thank you. That would be helpful.
Representative. Thank you, Mr. Chair. As a landlocked district landlubber myself, I'm not super familiar with exactly everything that this program looks like, so I appreciate the robust dialogue. I might start back from Ocean Rangers 101. What do Ocean Rangers look at exactly? Do they only look at the fecal coliform and the sewage discharge, or do they look at other aspects of discharge from the cruise ships?
You can go ahead and answer this one.
Representative Hopkins to the chair. So the Ocean Rangers would have been observing compliance with a variety of federal and state environmental requirements and reporting and whether or not the discharges were in compliance. But again, they didn't have the authority that a DEC staff person would have or the expertise that an inspector would have with respect to collecting evidence or keeping an appropriate record of something for enforcement purposes. But they were looking more broadly at, as the commissioner said, sneeze guards and other areas.
And we're at sneeze guards and fecal and sewage discharge in the water.
Jason Bruni on Representative Hopkins through the chair. They were looking at pools and at the nail salons and the food sanitation or food distribution areas, other health and safety practices. Okay, here, thank you. Pretty much so air pollution, oil and fuel, hazardous materials and solid waste, permitted ships, ballast water, wastewater, certificates, safety, health, and sanitation.
And so, thank you. Can I follow up? When we're looking at electronic monitoring, is that only for the sewage discharge? And how were the other from sneeze guards that you keep using as an example to diesel dumping or diesel leaking into the water, how are those monitored as well?
Chair Hopkins, the emphasis is going to be on wastewater discharge and other discharges that are coming out. From the shore, the air monitoring will continue to be done. The others, for the most part, have other regulatory oversight from the FDA or from other federal entities that inspect the ships as well. So much of what the Ocean Rangers do or have done, my understanding is, was duplicative. So the focus is going to be on the things that really have the largest risk potentially to the environment, and that is on what is coming out of the boat, both from an air and a wastewater process.
I thought you said that the air was going to be monitored from the shore just now.
Correct.
Okay. So, but that is being altered in this program so that it would be monitored by random inspections on the ship as well.
So, Representative Hopkins, I think air is not going to really see much change at all. It is the Ocean Rangers really didn't do much with respect to air. There was a contract that was done from the shore, as well as DEC trained folks are doing the Method 9 analysis of these. But most of those inspections come from the shore, and so it wasn't the Ocean Rangers that have been doing the air inspections.
Okay. they're observing a number of different discharges. With the electronic monitoring that you're proposing to put on these ships and allow them to deduct $1 out of their $5 per berth fee, would those be looking and tracking the other types of discharges that the Ocean Rangers currently look at?
Representative Hopkins, through the chair, it'll be focused on the wastewater discharge, the electronic monitoring, but giving us flexibility if new technology comes into the future that we could incorporate air monitoring if such technology exists in the future. Right now, it doesn't exist that I'm aware of.
And fuel leakage and things like that are not electronic? I have a dashboard light on my car that pops up when I have a fuel leak. Shouldn't that also be something that we're electronically monitoring and requiring them to track for us to allow the EPA to understand and to track?
Representative Hopkins, through the chair, I think that that is an issue that many ocean-going vessels deal with, fishing boats, ocean-going boats, the nice little rainbow sheen that you see afterwards. And when those type of reports are found, our spill prevention and response division absolutely responds to them. I don't know if there are similar monitoring type things for fuel, but I think that your recommendation is spot on. If such a thing exists, I would assume that we would want to know that.
We don't regulate in this bill currently we don't regulate the amount that the small fishing boats can dump in terms of sitting over the side of the boat to make sure that we have a head on the boat to be able to use. We don't look at that for small boats. So in the same way, we don't worry about the small amount of oil sheen that they can produce to the same extent that we worry about, you know, multi-thousand person people coming through our trip. So I would expect that this program would continue to look at those same environmental hazards that are coming out of the small cities that are coming into our ports. So I don't know why that would not be electronically regulated. If we're looking at an overhaul of this program, let's look at the whole program and make it work for protecting our oceans.
Representative Hopkins, if there is a way to electronically monitor when there is some kind of a leakage going on, absolutely, we're interested in that. And that is vital to protection of the environment. I think that and what I'll commit to doing is finding out what currently exists and getting back to you in the committee, because I think if we can incorporate something like that, we absolutely will.
Thank you.
Representative Hopkins, I would certainly like to hear from the industry about what current electronic monitoring systems can monitor. There have been cases where there have been illegal dumping of bags and trash. So, I think, we want to look at something that's going to capture the full range of potential discharges, whether it's fecal coliform or leaking fuel or these rare cases that there's actually trash being dumped in the water. And I don't remember the details on that case from Glacier Bay and how that actually happened.
Thank you. I'd be interested also. One more question as a follow-up. Inspections that you describe on page 12 of the ship, that would be that would occur as soon as possible in the season. Who would be responsible for scheduling those inspections and making sure that they happen?
Representative Hopkins, through the chair, DEC staff will be responsible for that, ultimately falling under the Division of Water, and Randy Bates, our water director.
Do you feel like you have enough staff to monitor and schedule the ships that come through?
Through the chair, Representative Hopkins, yes. In what we have proposed with the fiscal note and the supplemental, yes, I believe that we have. In fact, I would say, Representative Hopkins, if we are indeed comparing this industry and regulating it as other industries are regulating it, we're regulating this industry still way more than every other industry or community wastewater discharge or the air inspections that we do. This, they will still be more, significantly more than other industries. But in answer to your question, yes, I feel that we will have sufficient coverage for inspecting these ships sufficiently to meet the demand that we have from the Alaskan public that they're using Alaska's waters and environment in a responsible way.
All right. Thank you. I look forward to seeing how this develops.
Representative Price.
Thank you. Another question on the what will not change slide. Before I do it, because I mean this parallel is being made repeatedly. In terms of observer coverage in the fishing industry, the primary function of observers is, yes, collecting biological data of species being caught, but as much or more so, it's making sure that basically fishermen aren't cheating and that they're not catching fish when they're not supposed to. It's very much an oversight and regulatory function. I think that's sort of important to point out. In any large vessel, it's 100% coverage. And that's a little bit different than, you know, environmental oversight. But I just, in sort of drawing that parallel, I'm in my mind, it's not fully fair to say that the cruise ship industry is sort of, in fact, a complete and total outlier in terms of regulatory oversight, just per large boat commercial fishing observer coverage. But on the what will not change slide, I'm not familiar with the DEC vessel registration system. What is that? How does it work? What's its function?
Representative Chris Tompkins through the chair. This is Emma Pocan again for the record. So the registration system, my understanding is that basically any vessel that is going to be intending to operate in the marine waters of the state registers with the department in advance of coming into the waters. And some of those vessels intend to discharge while they're in state waters, and so then they are then put into the group that needs to get a permit or where they need to have a BMP if it's a small vessel. But DEC has a record of, through this registration program, a record of the vessels that are going to be in state waters during the operating season.
Follow up. BNP is, or what, could you unpack that acronym? I might not have heard all the letters correctly.
My apologies. Representative Chris Tompkins, it's the best management practices.
Follow up?
Yeah.
So if I understand the vessel registration system as described, every Lindblad expedition vessel or uncruised vessel, all of which have more than 50 overnight berths, are registrants in this system presently because they're in Alaska waters. Is that correct?
Representative Chris Tompkins, I believe so.
Okay, I think Representative Vance had a question.
Yes, thank you. I have a question. Page 13 is talking about the 10 DEC staff available, and it says that you're requesting 4 new DEC positions, and you mentioned you already have one of the marine engineers on staff, but you referenced funding in the supplemental budget. Can you talk about that in coordination with the request in this bill so that we can have an understanding of the transition that is alluded to in being able to prepare for this 2020 season?
Sure. Representative Vance, through the chair, what we have as the supplemental line item is $900,000, of which those 4 new DEC positions are included, as well as a contract to work with for the early season inspections for hiring marine engineers. Those 4 positions that are proposed, one of them is a marine engineer and 3 are the regular inspectors that we have. And so it would be expected that those individuals would then be maintained for the subsequent fiscal year. And so the full contract for the following year, we don't know if that will ultimately be done by DEC staff or DEC staff in conjunction with a marine engineer contract. Is that
follow up? Is that because you're not sure if you can fill the 4 positions with the engineers that you're looking for that you would need to contract in order to fill that gap?
So, Representative Vance, through the chair, I'm confident that we can fill 3 of those positions because it doesn't require a marine engineer position, and I'm hopeful that we will get a marine engineer for that fourth position. And then the marine engineers that will be required for doing those early season inspections, since we'll only have two and we'll want coverage for all of the ships that are coming into Alaska, we may need to bring on a contract or seasonal employees to be able to accommodate that, getting those 60 boats inspected early on in the season.
Great.
Thanks.
Thank you.
On page 9, the fourth bullet down, says new technology could provide for 24/7 electronic monitoring of ships' discharge ports. It said it could provide. Is that future technology that could provide it, or there's the potential for what we have now? They've got Wi-Fi on board. Can we say electronic monitoring will track this 24/7 and report to DEC all the time?
Representative Hopkins, through the chair, some of the newer built machine boats absolutely have technology that documents when the ports are open. Some of the older ships don't, and they're still handwriting them in logbooks. The ultimate thought is that when internet connectivity is amazing and those boats are underway and they open their ports, that there would be a real-time notification to DEC that a port is open. And or, I mean, that could be a lot of data that we would get. Potentially, we could do what's called geofencing. We could have a certain geographic location where we are notified if a port is open and it's not supposed to be. And all of the other times that their ports are open, we don't care, frankly. It's when they're discharging in an area where they're not supposed to be. That's where we really care about. When they're discharging in Glacier Bay, or when they're discharging and their permit doesn't allow them to discharge in a certain location, that's where I ultimately want to go to, so that we are informed of when they're doing something that they're not supposed to. And it might be for a emergency that they have to be discharging certain things, but at least we'll know about it. Again, I want to remind you that most of the violations that we learn about from the industry are self-reported. The violation that Representative Chair Fields referenced earlier in Glacier Bay recently was self-reported by the industry. We were immediately called when that occurred. So the ideal, though, would be to get to a point and give us the flexibility within our regs as technology evolves, as internet connectivity evolves, that we can incorporate that into real-time understanding of when these ports are open.
Story.
Yeah, it would be interesting if you haven't seen been down to the Alaska Marine Exchange. That's really worth seeing, and they do vessel monitoring and tracking.
Thanks. At this time, just to make sure we formally have the right bill before the committee, I move we adopt House Bill 74, version GH1117/6 as the committee's working document. At this time, Commissioner and staff, do you want to go through the sectional analysis, or was your goal just to go through the presentation today?
No. Chair Fields, whatever.
Eddies. Better wrong. I move that we adopt version House Bill 74, version 31-GH1117/S as the committee's working document. So with that, does the department want to go through the sectional analysis at this time?
Sure.
Okay.
Thank you, Representative Fields. For the record, Emma Pocan. So in version S, I'll just start off with Section 1 amends AS 4603-460 to clarify that DEC has the organizational flexibility to have the air division folks supervising air and water division folks overseeing water, and incorporates the authority to adopt regulations. Section 2 boils down a number of the subsections in existing AS 4603-463 to provide DEC with the broad authority to implement those, but then have the flexibility to adjust to changing circumstances in the future. And the intention is for those details in those subsections to be put into regulation. Section 3 is a relatively small change to 465A that will authorize DEC to determine what format and at what time reports are made to DEC, rather than the on a monthly basis and the level of specificity that's currently in the statute. Section 4 amends.
Thank you. On section 3, I'm just looking at the sectional, so I'm not looking at version S. But what is the desired flexibility or timing that the department envisions for submitting these reports?
I think that's something that we need to work on. We'll get back to you. In current statute, it says not later than five days after each calendar month of operation in state waters, and that it's provided on a monthly basis. I think that it's going to depend on a number of factors in terms of what makes sense for the staff and when they're doing inspections, or what's going to be most workable. Section 4 amends 465C to clarify DEC's authority to inspect vessel wastewater and air emission systems. And we've inserted in there, including well underway, just to make clear that, DEC has the authority to conduct these inspections, but it's not just while they're at port, that when it makes sense that there's the potential to have inspectors on board the vessels and observing operations as they're underway. Section 5 is a conforming amendment. Section 6 amends 465D to authorize DEC to require certain reports in a particular form. The intent here is to be getting those reports electronically and basically in a format that can feed into DEC's, computer programs easily, instead of, a photograph of somebody's handwritten log.
Question.
Representative Price Hopkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Not to be too clerically lurid in my curiosity, is that happening right now? You're getting texted photos of ship logs?
Representative Christ Tompkins, that's my understanding, yes.
Oh, wow.
Jason Bruni, Representative Christ Tompkins, my understanding was that the requirement in the initiative required electronic submission, and if you take a picture of a handwritten log, that is electronic. And so our staff was often spending time transcribing that information, which is a waste of technical staff's time. And our hope would be that we could get that in a format that would plug, like Deputy Commissioner Pocan said, that would plug into our systems and allow our staff to do better things with their time.
For the record, this seems like a wonderful upgrade.
Continuing on with the sectional, Section 7 and 8 are conforming amendments. Again, Section 9 amends, this is the new fee structure. It amends 480A to simplify the environmental compliance fee and what was previously the Ocean Ranger fee into a single $5 per berth fee for all of the vessels. That will take effect in January 2021, so we'll have this season to adjust, and then we'll have that new fee in place at the same time that we have the new regs established. Section 10 repeals and reenacts 480C to conform to changes that were made in A. Going back to Section 9, just also wanted to point out that also authorizes or would reduce that $5 fee by a dollar for vessels that install the electronic monitoring and make that information available to DEC.
Section 11 amends Section 482C to remove some obsolete language and to broaden the stated purposes for which the legislature might appropriate collected fees to include the grant or loan program that's created in the next section, Section 12. And that Section 12, again, is the section that will establish the authorized DEC to establish a grant or loan program. Section 13 is the section for repeals. Went through those in the presentation. Section 14 repeals the Ocean Ranger statute that's currently in 4603-476, and we do that separately so that it can be have a effective in April so that we can implement this season the DEC staff inspections and start transitioning to that. Section 15 is a transition language added to the uncodified law to authorize DEC to work on regulations before the bulk of the bill becomes effective, so that we'll have those new regulations ready to go in January 2021. Section 16 includes legislative intent language to clarify that $4 fee collected under 480D, the Ocean Ranger fee, may be used to fund DEC's compliance work over this season. Section 17 states that Section 14 is retroactive to April 2020. Section 18 provides an immediate effective date for Sections 14 through 17. And Section 19 provides the effective date of January 1, 2021 for the remainder of the bill.
Questions from committee members? Well, I've just been kind of keeping track of questions throughout, and I guess I'm just going to name these as kind of things that I think are worth thinking about, and definitely want to get the department's input as we reflect on this draft, and get stakeholders' input as well. What's the right metric for kind of a baseline for minimum number or percentage of sailings? It's great we're going to continue to inspect each vessel, but what percentage of total sailings should have onboard inspections? And I think a little more generally, what's the right balance of details for an inspection regime in this statute versus to be promulgated subsequently in regulation? A question I have for industry is the $1 berth fee reduction a good amount to incentivize installation and operating of 24/7 electronic monitoring, which I certainly share the goal of encouraging that and look forward to learning more from industry about the economics of installing and operating those systems. This is a relatively potentially complicated bill to draft in the sense that there are a bunch of different ways you could draft it and reach similar outcomes. So for lawyers and the public who are interested in water issues, I would welcome input on what's the right way to draft it. If we have what I think are broadly shared goals in terms of a regulatory regime, can we draft it better? Workforce issues. To me, it makes a lot of sense to use the expertise of marine engineers, and I still have that question. Are there other highly skilled occupations out there that could help augment our inspection regime, since there are a lot of vessels out there that need to be inspected? I have technical questions. Thanks, Representative Hopkins, for kind of elucidating those around what do electronic monitoring systems look for now? Do they look for fuel leaks? What's the range of capacities on different cruise ships owned by different companies? What percentage of cruise ships in Alaska right now have electronic monitoring? And to what extent can those report, say, to a contractor like the Marine Exchange? If we wanted to do that tomorrow, how long would that transition take? I'm curious about the Representative Christ-Tompkin mentioned the timing of submission of discharge reports. If it's not going to be monthly as an incurred statute, what's the right frequency? And finally, I'm curious, I guess this is really for stakeholders, members of the public, perhaps local governments, should there be sideboards on the percentage of these user fees that are invested in onboard inspections versus onshore infrastructure investments? You know, should there be some expectation of a certain balance or a minimum threshold for onboard investigations? So those are some of the issues that I think are worthy of discussion and we could learn more about in subsequent hearings. Representative Story.
Yes, I remember you saying what is best practices done in other ports for this, and I didn't know if that was on your list, but I would be interested in hearing back what other areas are doing.
Representative Hopkins.
Just a quick question. What is the penalty for a violation of these, what the Ocean Rangers find or what this program puts in place?
Representative Hopkins, through the chair, I think it varies depending on what the violation is. Depends on whether or not there's an EPA penalty policy that applies, or if we're looking to DEC's calculations that are sometimes different based on what's in our statutes. I can tell you, for example, that for the Glacier Bay incident, that produced a $18,000 penalty for the state violations that were involved.
Quick follow-up. Do you, of the six violations that the Ocean Rangers discovered, do you have any memory of what some of those penalties were? Okay. I got lots of people nodding no, so, or shaking their heads, so.
Through the chair, Representative Hopkins, we'll get back to you on that.
Representative Chris Tompkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In the repealer section, section 13, I had questions about the sort of origin or motivation of a couple of the laws being repealed or sections of statute. One is 4603485, which is the recognition program, which seems pretty innocuous as I read about it. The department may engage in efforts to encourage or recognize superior environmental protection efforts made by owners and operators of commercial passenger vessels. May, not shall, do it if you want, it sounds. Out of curiosity, what's the thinking in repealing that section of law?
Representative Chris Tompkins, I think that recognition program is something that DEC hasn't had the funding or the capacity to do anything sort of explicitly. I think DEC can always acknowledge good environmental performance by any of its permittees, but it's not something where, at least in recent years, that there's been any sort of time set aside to engage in that activity, specifically for cruise ships.
If I may, Mr. Chair, so in essence, you haven't done it in the past. You don't need a law giving you permission to do it. Let's just tighten up the laws a little bit and take it off the books. Is that basically the thinking in repealing that section of law?
Representative Chris Tompkins, yes.
Another question, Mr. Chair. 4603-491, this is the definition section. There's two definitions being repealed. One is subsection 15 in the definition section, which is the definition of untreated sewage. Technically or substantively, why repeal that definition?
Representative Chris Tompkins, so I guess the first thing that I'll point out is that there is also a definition of treated sewage in the preceding paragraph 14, and so that definition of untreated sewage is superfluous. I haven't had an opportunity to go back, but I know, for example, the definition in paragraph 1 that we propose to repeal, because that term is no longer in the existing statutes. The repeal of paragraph 15 was a revision from legislative legal, but I don't think we have any objection or concern about that, in part because we have the definition of treated sewage as well. So.
Thank you. If I may restate my understanding, so in effect, your understanding, given this didn't come from your attorneys, but rather our attorneys, albeit conduited through an office, is that both of these definition repealers are effectively conforming changes.
Representative Chris Tompkins, yes.
Thank you.
Representative Vance.
Thank you. I just want to comment on my support for the Section 12 of this that adds support for the shore-based treatment facilities. I admire the fact that you've met the request to continue to have the regulations for the ocean, what was previously the Ocean Ranger program, but have gone a further step in providing a venue for the shore-based communities to be able to upgrade their systems as well. That's so needed in our communities, and I know that Homer has a more modernized water and sewer treatment plant, but one of the things that we did in our community with the funds received from the cruise ship industry was put in bathrooms downtown and in different places where the cruise ship passengers would be going, because our community didn't have the capacity for more people in the community. And this takes it more than just building a bathroom. This is working on the discharge that's going to affect the residents and the future generations there. So I'm excited about what this is going to become and being able to impact the communities in the future in working with the compliance of these cruise ships as we move forward. So thank you for your efforts and your due diligence for that.
Thank you, Representative Vance.
Representative Christ-Hopkins.
Thank you. One last question on repealers 4603-462, which is the terms and conditions of discharge permits. I to some extent, this is like a repeal and reenact bill, so it's kind of like trying to put all the pieces together and figure out which components interact with others. So I'm doing a little bit on the fly, and I wanted see if you basically help me out with this section being repealed. Is there sort of an equivalent reenactment that is occurring, and if so, in what section?
Representative Christ-Tompkins, so the provisions that are in current Section 462 in statute were terms and conditions of discharge permits, and the thinking is that in Section 2, where we have the broad language for AS 4603-463, the prohibited discharges, that language in Section 2 will authorize DEC to regulate and put into regulation the comparable provisions as for what's currently in 462.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So in effect, I mean, the sectional analysis says Section 2 repeals and reenacts 46.03.463. In effect, if I understand what you just said, Ms. Pocon, is that Section 2 repeals and reacts AS 46.03.463 and .462. To some extent.
Representative Christ-Tompkins, I think that's a fair characterization, yes.
Okay, thank you.
Seeing other questions, so I think our intention is to return to this bill. I certainly want to hear from stakeholders about some of those questions I just mentioned. I'm sure we'll have more discussions with the department, and thanks to everyone for attending and great discussion, and thanks to the department and also to Ledge Legal for working through the initial drafts. At 4:27, House State Affairs is adjourned.